President and Bishop of the Court of Appeals.
Good morning.
And that, I believe, has now taken place. Mr. Soucy, good morning to you. You may approach and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Jerry Soucy. I represent the appellant in this matter, Ricky Sanders. The habeas action arising out of a conviction under Nebraska Revised Statute 28-12.1212.04. The issue raised in the habeas petition was a very simple one. It was that the statute under which Mr. Sanders was convicted, sentenced to prison, is unconstitutional on its face. If that claim is correct, then his conviction was void ab initio. He is entitled under the habeas corpus statutes to his discharge as a matter of law.
Isn't the question here as to whether or not habeas corpus is a means to attack the constitutionality of a statute by bringing a facial challenge after the sentence and conviction have become final?
That's the issue why it's up here.
Right.
Because that was the sole basis upon which the district court declined to grant the habeas corpus petition. It did not address any of the merits of the allegations. In that regard, I think it is important to recognize that there is a difference between the rights under the habeas corpus statute, which recently this court recognized as a constitutional dimension on the part of the district court, Jesse B. versus Tyler H. habeas action, 293 Nebraska 973, decided in June after this case was decided. There's some absolutely wonderful language in that opinion explaining how important habeas corpus is. The fact that it is a great writ, that's what it's called, is not an accident. It is the opportunity by which the courts can correct injustices that have been committed. In regards to your specific question, let's simply walk through the procedures by which an individual is prosecuted. An individual is arrested and charged in county court. When he is in county court, the county court judge has no authority to declare whether the statute is constitutional. However, an inmate under those circumstances can file for a writ of habeas corpus saying, I'm being held by the sheriff of Lancaster County, Douglas County,
That may be true, but under what you're giving as an analysis now is there's no finality that's been entered in the case with regard to a judgment or conviction. In other words, you can start attacking this the minute you're charged, but there are means to do that. And habeas can be one of those means if there's not a final conviction involved.
But the point is that the reason Sanders lost earlier was because this court said he didn't file a motion to quash. His lawyer didn't file a motion to quash. And in that opinion, they said it was a novel issue. The issue is not whether it's novel for the purposes of the Sixth Amendment, first prong of Strickland. The issue is whether the argument has merit. And in that regard, if a statute is unconstitutional, it is unconstitutional today. It's going to be unconstitutional 2 years from now. It was unconstitutional 5 years ago.
But can we reach that in this case?
Absolutely, and you've done it before.
Well, but in other cases, there has not been a finality of the judgment or conviction.
That's not true.
Which case did we reach habeas where we didn't have a final?
Behrman versus Cassidy. In Behrman versus Cassidy, the sentence was final. And Cassidy had been found guilty of second offense DWI. And at that point, after the conviction and sentence was final, they looked at it and said, oh, oops, we made a mistake. One of his convictions was uncounseled. It was void as a matter of law for the purpose of his sentencing.
Well,
this court then approved the grant of habeas corpus.
Yeah, okay.
And that was the case on which the case was final.
But you're asking us now to make a ruling on the constitutionality of this statute in a habeas action after Sanders' conviction and sentence have been final, and he's had a direct appeal in which he did not raise those issues. he said post-conviction, in which this court found that counsel, trial counsel was not ineffective because this was a novel issue. And now you're attempting to raise the same issue in the habeas action. And you have to do that by alleging that this statute under which he is convicted is void ab initio.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. I am saying that but statute can, was
can,
void.
Can we reach that in the habeas?
Absolutely. Let me give you an example. In my brief, I cite a number of cases, one of which I cite is a miscegenation statute that was on the books in Nebraska. Nebraska, unfortunately, was a party to a number of Jim Crow laws. It was a felony for a black and white couple to be married if the black person was 1/8 black. That statute went off the books in 1962. It was never challenged on the merits. There was one case that came up in which this court never addressed the merits of whether or not that was a violation of equal protection, but it did rule that since the couple had gotten married in Iowa, that it couldn't be applied to Nebraska under the Privileges and Immunity Clause. It was an as-applied situation in which they avoided being convicted. But now assume that an individual had been convicted under that statute, did not make the novel argument that it was a violation of equal protection. Loving versus Virginia comes down, does not hold a Nebraska statute specifically unconstitutional. I think that it would be absurd to suggest that somebody sitting in prison in violation of that statute could not file habeas corpus and say, wait a minute, this statute is unconstitutional. And that would be an example that I would use. I think that what
but counsel, wouldn't that be a change of law so you could file a post-conviction?
Well,
under our new post-conviction, if the law changes, you can then come back even if you've had one post-conviction. Correct?
Well, apparently Mr. Sanders couldn't do that because he tried to do it in post-conviction and it would have been a novel claim. And if you're suggesting that he could have gone back on post-conviction and say that statute was void ab initio, what I'm saying is it doesn't make any difference whether you do it in post-conviction or you do it in habeas corpus, where that's been recognized as a legitimate way of challenging the facial unconstitutionality of the statute. It is possible he could have done it by post-conviction, but I would not have been my recommendation. My recommendation was go right to the point of the matter, file your habeas corpus action. That statute's unconstitutional. You shouldn't be in prison.
Right, but my point is your example cited something where the law changed. In this case, the law didn't change, is my point.
Law has never been addressed.
Okay, but it's never been changed, correct?
Well,
the law he's convicted under is the same law today. There's never been no change in the law or Supreme Court case throwing out this law, correct?
Well, the principle has always been there. The principle has always been in the Constitution. But the principle has always been in the decision I decided, the Galloway versus Wolf case, the Green versus State case. That principle has existed for 90 years.
Did he waive his right to contest this?
You cannot. I normally don't enjoy listening to workers' comp cases, but when they were just in here before, they were talking about jurisdiction, how the county court you can't waive jurisdiction. He cannot waive his prosecution under an unconstitutional statute. You just can't.
Can't waive the contesting of the prosecution.
He can't waive any of it. I mean, if that statute's unconstitutional, the entire prosecution, appeal, everything else.
Haven't we said it's fundamental process of law that a prisoner can waive his right to a constitutional challenge?
He can't waive the jurisdiction of the court. That's a fundamental.
Well, I understand
that. In order for the county court, the district court, everybody to have acted, this statute has to be constitutional.
Well, but there's a presumption here that there's. Where have we found that this statute is unconstitutional on its face?
You never had the chance.
I understand that.
You never
but
had
there
the chance.
There were opportunities for that were not taken. And now you're arguing that he's entitled to another bite at this apple under this basis that we've never said this before.
Except that he's never had a bite at the apple. What he had was, when he had on direct appeal, his lawyer raised solely the sufficiency of the evidence. That was only handled by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals had no jurisdiction to find plain error that the statute was unconstitutional.
Yeah, and it wasn't raised in the Court of Appeals.
I understand that, but what was discussed in one of the opinions, and I believe it was in Sanders' opinion, is it talks about these early opinions.
Do you see the distinction between the U.S. Supreme Court having made a decision in which it struck down similar statutes and held them to be unconstitutional on their face, and a case where there's been no ruling by any court anywhere as to this particular statute's constitutionality?
This particular statute or the principle?
This particular statute.
This particular statute has never been challenged.
And so isn't it presumed to be constitutional?
You start with the presumption until you're faced with the fact that it only applies to Douglas County and Lancaster County. I mean, assume that you had a statute that said growing marijuana is illegal throughout the state of Nebraska, except in counties where they don't have cities of the first class, metropolitan or primary class. The court's head would spin looking at that statute and
You're saying it's void because it's special legislation?
It is. That is obvious on the face. That is obvious on the face. And how everybody missed it is beyond me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Love, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, George Love on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. I would just begin by pointing out that the statute is presumed constitutional, and you can waive both constitutional and statutory rights by not timely asserting your challenge to those statutes or the invocation of the statutory right. In this particular case, it's a waiver. There's no motion to quash ever filed in the trial court. He therefore waived his constitutional challenge to the statute. Now on collateral, and there was a final judgment.
What about counsel's argument that he never really was given a chance to argue the constitutionality of this statute?
That's
because
nonsense.
Well, trial counsel didn't raise it on appeal. There was no motion to quash, and then his opportunity to challenge it on post-conviction is we made a determination that this was a novel issue, and therefore counsel was not ineffective for not raising it, but we never addressed whether or not the statute was in fact facially invalid.
Then that logic would dictate that I can raise any issue at any time, regardless of finality of judgment, by any vehicle I so choose at any point in the proceeding.
And your argument is that we don't allow these types of challenges in habeas corpus proceedings.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. This court has specifically stated in the Mayfield decision that a writ of habeas corpus in the state is a limited action and it cannot be used to correct errors. And that's exactly assuming, and I don't know that you've even gotten over the presumption of the constitutionality of the statute, but assuming without proof or any argument that the statute is unconstitutional.
What if you had a habeas challenge after the same proceedings, but habeas is brought, and it's so obvious that this statute is unconstitutional on its face that there never could have been a valid conviction to begin with, even though it wasn't challenged? In other words, no African American shall have any rights in the state of Nebraska.
That's irrelevant, Your Honor. That would be
obviously on its face, that would be unconstitutional, right?
This court for 60 years at least has said that the constitutionality of the statute renders a sentence voidable, not void, and that's what we're talking about here, the sentence, not the correction of any error. You don't even get there. So the sentence is what has to be challenged here. That sentence, presumption of the constitutionality of statute, is valid. He waived his right to challenge the constitutionality of statute via
Would that, could you,
failure to file a
could
motion
you apply
to
that presumption to the statute even though it's so obvious that it's facially invalid?
You're asking me, is a waiver possible? Yes. That's been jurisprudence since time immemorial. And that's what this court has held in numerous cases.
So the time for raising this, was probably at the beginning of the charge.
I couldn't hear the first part.
The time for raising it was really at the beginning of
that's
the time
correct,
the charge
Your Honor,
was filed.
And it's,
In which court?
Pardon me?
When to raise it, in which court?
He should have raised it probably in district court, stood, moved, and filed a motion to quash when he was arraigned on the information.
So is that failure fatal at that point?
Yes.
Is there any way to remedy that?
Nope.
Well, you have
because
post-conviction.
Because it's a novel issue?
Yeah, post-conviction.
He has post-conviction under a claim of ineffective assistance to counsel for not raising, and this court held that for not raising a novel issue, that's not deficient performance. So it's not what I think the court is saying.
Well,
is,
would we allow a challenge brought by habeas when the conviction and sentence were not filed?
That has happened.
Not final, I mean.
That's correct. That has happened. But that's not a collateral attack.
That's a direct attack.
The vehicle used is a writ of habeas corpus. I'm being unlawfully held under unconstitutional statute. And again,
then you can litigate the constitutionality of the statute.
Correct, because it's analogous to a motion to quash. In other words, the title of the on a direct assault. The title of the document really isn't an issue here. It's whether it's raised properly to challenge the statute. Not on a collateral attack, but on direct. And that's what the writ is being used for. Is in this case, is an attempt to collaterally attack a final judgment by an improper procedure. The court is so held, it can't be used as a writ for correction of error. Open the door to that, then you can allege anything. Anything becomes possible, and there is no final judgment whatsoever. That's simple. And the presumption of the statute has never been overcome, Your Honor, and there is the law provides a method and a procedure to exercise your rights in that matter. We don't believe that this court is particularly held, that the judgment is on the constitutionality is only voidable, not void. It has to be completely void. So in other words, the idea that a defendant or a convicted person can use the vehicle of a writ of habeas corpus then would be a method for him to challenge every error at trial. Why would it be limited to constitutionality?
Well, I mean, this case has future implications if a writ is allowed to, if the parties are
absolutely
allowed to
as
bring
a matter
this
of
writ,
policy, you
what prevents every single prisoner in the state from bringing
right.
a habeas
you've
action?
You completely reversed all of the precedent with respect to void and voidability of the sentence, not used for correction of error, et cetera, et cetera. It's the doors open.
Mr. Love, I'd like to
it's
go back.
It's a floodgates argument, but it's a valid one. It's a valid one.
I'd like to go back to something Justice Funk said about it being fatal then if at the district court level defense counsel fails to challenge the statute at that point. So your position is that there's no other process for challenging the constitutionality of a statute if it was not raised at the trial level?
The answer is I think...
You are arguing...
But
the judgment's not final yet. If the judgment's not final, you can still raise it in habeas.
That's correct.
But if trial counsel fails to raise it and a conviction is entered, then it's too late?
Yep. That's called finality of judgment.
Because when they attempted to bring an action for post-conviction relief on ineffective assistance of counsel, this court determined that it wasn't ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right.
And
based
so
that,
then
yeah.
it's done?
That's right. Eventually you have to say it's over.
Counsel, can you address, at oral argument, the appellant said we've allowed this type of proceeding in Berman versus Cassidy. And in his brief, he also cites Ex parte Maher, what, claiming their final judgments and habeas was allowed.
If I recall, the judgment in the Berman case, if I recall, that's because there was no evidence that supported the enhancement with respect to the conviction of DUI. In other words, the sentence was void.
But it was final, but you agree that right. That was a final
it was
judgment?
It was void, yes.
But it was okay, final judgment.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the sentence was void, and that's what was going on there, if my memory serves me correctly. Here, this sentence was final a long time ago. And what I want, what he wants, is another bite at the apple and say that there is no finality of judgment as long as I can invent a vehicle by which to bring it into court and attack the judgment. In other words, my attack is only limited by imagination henceforth, if this writ can be used to collaterally attack a judgment on error.
But I think Mr. Soucy is saying there hasn't been a bite at the apple. There may have been opportunities.
That's right,
to bite,
but there's an opportunity.
But that's what the state is saying. Opportunities have presented themselves.
That's right. You've had your opportunity. And eventually you lose those opportunities. You don't get to go back and keep trying to exercise an opportunity, which by definition you're only limited by your imagination then. So nothing is final. As long as I can sit there and dream up issues or a way to attack it, nothing is final. That's why we raised res judicata at the trial level. Now, I know the district court didn't decide it on that issue. It basically found that, and we believe that the district court can't be found to have erred in following the precedent of this court, bottom line. It can't be found to have been wrong.
But the lower court didn't address the res judicata.
That's correct.
And you didn't cross appeal on that one. And you didn't cross appeal
on
that.
No, that's correct. That's correct. We did raise the issue only in brief. In other words, right result, wrong reason, right reason, wrong result. Take your choice. Point being is that res judicata argument is directly connected to the idea you can't keep collaterally attacking a final judgment. And that's what the writ stands for. So it's another basis to say you can't keep attacking a final judgment over and over again. And that's what's going on here.
I'll just use a broad statement, the system requires an opportunity to attack a statute.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You have an opportunity to challenge the legality of your proceedings in a variety of ways at the trial court level, and as well as on appeal. But once the appellate courts have said this is now done, final judgment, mandate issued, everything else after that really basically becomes a collateral attack, same with post-conviction, writ of habeas corpus, so on and so forth. And if that is not a final judgment after the mandate issued, which this court would be holding, then I am only limited by my imagination as to how I can challenge a final conviction, period. Never final. Never. And we would ask that you affirm that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? There is no... excuse me. There is no time for rebuttal. The court is adjourned and you are excused.